Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with a couple of segments I've entitled Connecting the Dots. I'm presenting information that has been presented in past broadcasts, for the most part, and that will be familiar to veteran and regular listeners. However, in order to tie in some of the seemingly disparate contexts and lines of inquiry that I've covered in the past, I'm juxtaposing some of these segments from past programs, or material from past programs, in order to help solidify the listener's understanding of how some of these seemingly obscure or disparate elements fit together. In our last half-hour segment, we were talking about the book Serpent's Walk. This is put out by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important and most dangerous of the domestic Nazi groups. As I've said in the past, researchers who are looking into the book Serpent's Walk, which I think is extremely important, should be extremely careful because the National Vanguard is not the Boy Scouts, or the National Alliance, rather, is not the Boy Scouts of America. Serpent's Walk was put out by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991. The address for National Vanguard Books, and extreme caution should be used in dealing with this group. National Vanguard Books can be reached at Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. That's National Vanguard Books, P.O. Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. This book is about an SS takeover in the middle of the 21st century, after the SS has gone underground, built up its capital, and then bought into the American opinion-forming media, infiltrating the army, and then taking over the United States when the Speaker of the House becomes president and invites them into a ruling coalition. Again, for a more detailed analysis, there's a half-hour segment available from Spitfire entitled A Review and Analysis of Serpent's Walk. After discussing the Flight Capital Organization that takes over the United States, or basically that the SS have built up, there's discussion in the book Serpent's Walk of how this post-World War II SS Flight Capital Organization, basically the SS in underground form, and that's something that actually did happen. I would refer interested listeners to a half-hour segment entitled Odessa, Then and Now, available from Spitfire, which talks about the Odessa and the SS going underground, where they worked in conjunction with the Reinhard Galen spy outfit that jumped from the Third Reich to Western Intelligence and the CIA at the end of World War II. One of the things that's discussed in the book Serpent's Walk is the funding of so-called neo-Nazis, both in the United States and in Germany, by this post-World War II underground Reich. And again, one of the reasons that I accord the book Serpent's Walk the importance that I accord it is that this book, in my opinion, is not a novel. It purports to be a novel. In reality, this is based on things that can be well documented, and I'm afraid that failing drastic intervention by concerned parties, I'm afraid Serpent's Walk is going to become reality. Of the funding of the activities of so-called neo-Nazis by this post-World War II SS corporate underground, we read from Serpent's Walk. By the way, the author of this book is Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L, a nom de plume, I suspect, but of the post-World War II SS corporate funding and underground Reich funding of so-called neo-Nazi activities, it's not a term I like, they're Nazis, they're not neo-Nazis, we read in Serpent's Walk as follows. Lessing, who is a mercenary assigned to guard one of these SS corporate fronts, is talking with one of the SS faithful, namely a guy named Wrench, and that's the conversation that is conducted here, and we took a look at the discussion between Wrench and Lessing in our last half-hour segment. Turning to Serpent's Walk, we read, Lessing asks Wrench, "What about the neo-Nazis, the Missouri Seven, the gang who blew up the power station in Munich in 2040? Wrench waved a manicured hand. Quote, "They're part of it. Every movement needs street troops. Our enemies are tough. We're tougher. Anyhow, there's no such thing as a neo-Nazi. You're either with us or you're part of a problem." And again, one of the reasons why I accord the book Serpent's Walk the importance that I accord it is that it appears to be far more than a novel, and that what it talks about to a considerable extent can be verified. As I've said in the past, it is my opinion that the Jonas Utrum character in this book, he's the Speaker of the House who was a secret Nazi ally, and he ultimately brings the SS into partnership ruling over the United States. It is my opinion that Jonas Utrum is in fact based on Newt Gingrich. And certainly there is documentation that so-called neo-Nazi activities in the United States and Europe have been bankrolled by some of these Third Reich alumni. We're going to turn once again to the book Unholy Alliance, subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. This book was authored by Peter Levenda, L-E-V-E-N-D-A. It was published in softcover by Avon Books and copyright 1995. And in Unholy Alliance, there's a discussion of financing of the Order. That was a Nazi group that robbed banks and armored cars and murdered Denver talk show host Alan Berg in the 1980s. There's discussion of this group having been financed, to a certain extent, by German, quote, families, unquote, living in Latin America. Turning once again to Unholy Alliance, Levenda writes, according to one informant who told the story to former Order member Thomas Martinez, the Order was receiving contributions from German families, unquote, living in South America. This German Nazi, South American Nazi, North American Nazi link is reinforced by stories that German neo-Nazi terrorist Manfred Raeder, for instance, met with Dr. Josef Mengele in Brazil as late as 1978 before coming to the States and meeting with American neo-Nazi groups. Raeder was eventually convicted of the 1980 firebombing of a Vietnamese shelter in Hamburg, Germany, which killed two of the boat people. And by the way, in addition to the funding of the Order by German, quote, families, unquote, living in South America, three guesses who that might be, please note here that there are a number of stories that Manfred Raeder met with Josef Mengele. There are reports that Manfred Raeder met with Josef Mengele prior to coming to North America to meet with American, quote, neo, unquote, Nazis. In a half-hour segment available from Spitfire, we took a look at Manfred Raeder, who in 1995 was hired to lecture to the elite German Officers Academy in Germany about German colonization of Kaliningrad, formerly part of East Prussia. And Raeder's Nazi organization also received financial assistance and some old vehicles from the German army. And again, a full discussion of the Raeder incident in a half-hour segment available from Spitfire. A successor group to the Order, a group that was apparently called Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers, or CAUSE, emerged in the 1990s, according to information presented in the book Blood Oath, co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. That book is subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. In Blood Oath, there's discussion of this Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers group, composed largely of law enforcement, military, and intelligence veterans with covert action experience. This group not only killed Nicole Brown Simpson and framed O.J. Simpson, part of what was termed, an operation termed Operation Thunderbolt by this Nazi underground group, but the timing of the killing of Nicole and the framing of O.J. was structured in such a way as to coincide with the 10th anniversary of the murder of Alan Berg by the group The Order that we just heard about. Blood Oath was based on information provided to Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers by an anonymous informant codenamed Skinner, who said that he was part of the actual strike team that killed Nicole and framed O.J. I would add that there's information in the book Blood Oath that has never been made public and that could only have come from someone who had firsthand knowledge of the killings. It's one of the reasons I give it very high credibility. In the book Blood Oath, the allegation is made by Skinner that the group's operations were funded by a foreign terrorist group with unlimited financial capacity, and the context suggests the strong possibility that this may be a German Nazi group, although that is not an airtight connection. But the evidence suggests very strongly that the funding was from a German Nazi group, because at the very same time that the Order was doing, or that the CAUSE group was doing what they were doing, German Nazi elements were engaging in firebombings and beatings and a number of terrorist incidents, and this caused some PR problems for Germany in the early 1990s. Turning now to the book Blood Oath, by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. This book was published in softcover by Rainbow Books, copyright 1996. And of the backing of the CAUSE group that not only killed Nicole and framed O.J., but also, according to Skinner, pulled off the Oklahoma City bombing, according to Skinner, this group had assistance from abroad. Reading from Blood Oath, what made this group far more dangerous than any before was that it had unlimited financial assistance from a foreign terrorist group. and still more about this foreign terrorist group later on in Blood Oath. Now, the generals refers to the leaders of this particular group. The group operates in blind cells, so the various cells of this organization don't know who the others are. That is known only to the generals, the leaders of the group, and the contact point between the group that Skinner was part of, the six-man team that dispatched Nicole and framed O.J., the leader of this group is called the Deliverer. And later, apparently, well after the killing of Nicole and the framing of O.J., the leader was apparently dispatched by the generals when, for one reason or another, they felt uncomfortable with the situation as it was developing. More about the foreign backers of the cause group that killed O.J. That killed Nicole, framed O.J., and according to Skinner, pulled off the Oklahoma City bombing. Turning to Blood Oath, we read, Margie, by the way, is the widow of the Deliverer, the leader of this group. Between sobs, Margie told us how, even though the generals were satisfied with our results, the foreign group that had supplied the funds for the operation grew concerned because of the international notoriety the case was gaining and how the tide of world opinion was turning. She was able to piece together, from some of the phone conversations she overheard, how a race war the backers were conducting in their own part of the world was causing an image problem with the U.S. and its allies. She was sure the backers had killed her husband to silence him. They didn't know how truly committed he was. He would never have come forward about the assassination without their approval. She said she had secretly left the country via Canada to meet. She said he had secretly left the country via Canada to meet with them. She didn't know who they were. They were known only to the Deliverer. Now, crying openly, Margie choked on her words. He called and said he now feared for his life. It was something they found out, but he didn't know what it was. He was flying back to Canada immediately. That was last Thursday. He never made it back. I got an anonymous call on Sunday. The voice said he died of a heart attack, but I know better, unquote. And again, at least according to people like Margie and Skinner, the Deliverer was dispatched by the generals. By the way, that's one of the advantages to the blind cell technique. If something goes wrong in an operation, all you have to do is to, one way or another, neutralize the one contact man with the commanders of the organization, and that sanitizes that particular element of the operation. It's one of the methodological advantages of this technique. I'm going into this, again, to help connect some of the dots between the seemingly disparate areas of inquiry that I've engaged in the past. By the way, with regard to Third Reich alumni funding the activities of the current generation of German Nazis, there's information in the aforementioned half-hour segment, Odessa, Then and Now, that information in turn taken from the book The New Reich by Michael Schmidt. Michael Schmidt was interviewing German Nazi leader Michael Kunin, who later died of AIDS, and Kunin revealed that he was getting financial, his group occasionally got financial assistance from a successor organization to the Odessa. Now, in our first half-hour segment, we talked about the Dillon Reed Company, one of the main Wall Street elements in the American end of this transatlantic financial, industrial, and, as we shall see, ideological axis that I've been talking about. We also took a look at Brigadier General William H. Draper, Jr., a former corporate treasurer with Dillon Reed and a key official with a Dillon Reed Company that specialized in promoting investments in Hitler-era Germany. Brigadier General William Draper was in charge of the economic reconstruction of Germany in the U.S. section, in the U.S. Occupied zone of Germany after World War II, and as such, as we looked at in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program and the two half-hour segments about the tides of 20th century capital flow, Brigadier General William Draper oversaw the reconstruction and the perpetuation of the German industrial and financial elite that comprised the German end of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, a key American element of which was Draper and Dillon Reed. One of Draper's relatives, Wycliffe Draper, of the same Draper textile family, was also a key player in 20th century fascism. One of the major transatlantic links of fascism that goes again from the United States to Europe, Germany in particular, concerns the eugenics connection. Eugenics is a pseudoscience which, in fact, presents a pseudoscientific and alleged genetic basis for confirmed and long-standing social prejudices such as racism, anti-Semitism, and so forth. Eugenics was a major power and is a major influence in the United States, and in fact, American eugenics legislation and thinking exerted a profound influence over the Nazi racial legislation and the German eugenicists, who ultimately spawned the Nazi racial laws which led to the extermination programs at Auschwitz. I've discussed eugenics and the German-American eugenics connection, sort of the ideological component of this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, in a couple of miscellaneous archive shows available from Spitfire. One of those is Euthanasia and Reproductive Rights in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America from March of 1988, and the other is The Seeds of Nuremberg, a miscellaneous archive series from the spring of 1994. And again, those are available from Spitfire. One of the major source books discussing the German-American eugenics connection is the book The Nazi Connection, subtitled Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism. That book is authored by Stefan Kuhl, K-U-U-M-L-A-U-T-H-L. Kuhl is described on the back cover as a sociologist and historian at the University of Bielefeld in Germany. This landmark work, again entitled The Nazi Connection, Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism, was published in hardcover by the Oxford University Press and copyright 1994. One of the major elements in the eugenics connection, and an element of ideological and political continuity from the eugenics of the Hitler period to the eugenics of today, is the Pioneer Fund. The Pioneer Fund was one of the major factors behind the racist bestseller The Bell Curve that topped the New York Times bestseller list in 1994. And as we saw in The Seeds of Nuremberg, and as we'll touch on again right now, the Pioneer Fund not only influenced and praised and supported Hitler's racial legislation, particularly the early racial legislation, but in turn, the Pioneer Fund luminaries such as Harry Laughlin were honored by the Nazi-dominated academe in the late 1930s. Please note that the chief financial backer of the Pioneer Fund was Wycliffe Draper. Now, Wycliffe Draper is of the same textile empire family, the Drapers, that Brigadier General William Draper was from, the fellow from Dillon Read we looked at in our first segment. Turning to the Nazi connection about the Pioneer Fund, its connections to Hitler, and its activities in the present period, and the financing of the Pioneer Fund by Wycliffe Draper, a relative of William Draper, Jr., we read, Harry H. Laughlin and Frederick Osborne, scientists who played a leading role in the American eugenics movement, and, as I will illustrate, who supported Hitler's race policy, initiated the Pioneer Fund in 1937. Textile magnate Wycliffe Draper acted as its primary benefactor. The fund's stated purpose was to, quote, improve the character of the American people, unquote, by encouraging the procreation of descendants of, quote, white persons who settled in the original 13 colonies prior to the adoption of the Constitution and or from related stocks, unquote, and to provide aid in conducting research on, quote, race betterment with special preference to the people of the United States, unquote. Today, the Pioneer Fund is the most important financial supporter of research concerning the connection between race and heredity in the United States. It also continues to finance studies in the areas of eugenics, human genetics, and immigration. More about Wycliffe Draper, the financial backer of the Pioneer Fund, and his activities up into the 1960s, skipping down. Wycliffe Draper, who until the 1960s served as both the main benefactor and the most influential figure in the Pioneer Fund, also worked with the United States House Un-American Activities Committee to demonstrate that blacks were genetically inferior and ought to be, quote, repatriated, unquote, to Africa. And again, Wycliffe Draper is of the same textile family as Brigadier General William Draper of Dillon Read, and the chief American official in charge of reinstituting the Nazi financial and industrial elite at the end of World War II. We're going to turn to the July 1998 issue of the Searchlight magazine. Now, the Searchlight is a British anti-fascist publication, not to be confused with the American Spotlight, its opposite number. The July 1998 issue of the Searchlight concerns the eugenics movement and its influence on Nazism. The cover is entitled Gene War. And in this July 1998 issue of the Searchlight, there's an article entitled The Funding of the Science about the Pioneer Fund. It's co-authored by Barry Mailer, director, and Keith Hurt, research associate of the Institute for the Study of Academic Racism. And of Wycliffe Draper and the Pioneer Fund. Well, first of all, we're going to talk about the Pioneer Fund's support for the Bell Curve. Most of the leading Anglo-American academic race scientists of the past several decades have been funded by the Pioneer Fund, including William Shockley, Hans J. Eysenck, Arthur Jensen, Roger Pearson, Richard Lynn, J. Philippe Rushton, R. Travis Osborne, Linda Gottfredson, Robert A. Gordon, Daniel R. Vining Jr., Michael Levin, and Seymour Itzkoff, all cited in the bell curve. Now we're going to talk more about Wycliffe Draper. Now bear in mind the Draper textile family's company towns in New England. You heard a reference to that in a discussion of the background of Brigadier General William Draper Jr. from The Splendid Blonde Beast. Coordinate that or collate that with the information from this particular article about Wycliffe Draper, his relative. We read, Draper grew up in Hopedale, Massachusetts, a company town built by his family, living in what one historian has called, quote, a quasi-feudal manor house, unquote. The company maintained almost total control over the lives of company workers until 1912. Now, that again is Wycliffe Draper of the Draper family. What we're going to do now is to come back to William H. Draper, Jr., the Brigadier General who was formerly a Dillon Reed official and who then worked after the war to help restore the German financial and industrial elite. And we're going to take a look at him in a quasi-eugenics context, not unlike the type of activity favored by his relative, Wycliffe Draper. We're going to turn to the landmark recent book, Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional. This book is authored by Leonard Horowitz, Dr. Leonard Horowitz, published in hardcover by Tetrahedron Incorporated, copyright 1996. And this book makes a very convincing case that AIDS and Ebola were man-made and, in all likelihood, deliberately created. I realize that's a tall order. There are, first of all, there's an archive show entitled RFA 16 about the probable deliberate creation of AIDS as a genetically engineered biowarfare weapon. And there are also several discussions with Dr. Leonard Horowitz available from Spitfire, an hour interview that I conducted in the fall of 1997, and a massive interview with Dr. Horowitz, Ed Haslam, Alan Cantwell, and Dr. Garth Nicholson. All of those available from Spitfire. One of the elements leading up to the probable deliberate creation of AIDS was the perceived need on the part of U.S. foreign policymakers under the Nixon administration for a need to reduce the population in the Third World in order to reduce political unrest. And what we're going to do now is to turn to Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, Nature, Accident, or Intentional by Dr. Leonard Horowitz. We read, only days after the Department of Defense requisitioned the $10 million from Congress to fund the development of AIDS-like viruses, on July 29, 1969, the House Republican Research Committee Task Force on Earth Resources and Population, chaired by the Honorable George Bush of Texas, cited the urgent need for population control activities to fend off a growing Third World crisis. Earlier in the week, their committee had heard from General William H. Draper, Jr., National Chairman of the Population Crisis Committee, and Dr. William Moran, President of the Population Reference Bureau. That's the same William Draper, the relative of Wycliffe Draper from Dillon Reed and the U.S. Allied Control Council that we looked at earlier. Once again, testifying before Congress at the invitation of George Bush, then a congressman from Texas, and himself an individual whose family was deeply involved with this transatlantic financial and industrial axis, as we looked at in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program. William Draper Jr. is testifying before Congress about the need to hold down Third World population. And again, Len Horowitz maintains that AIDS, at least to a certain extent, appears to have been developed to do just exactly that. Skipping down, after talking about how George Bush, then a representative from Texas, brought the House up to speed on the expert testimony, following his speech, population control was thought so urgent that President Nixon, quote, proposed a major transformation in the foreign assistance program of the United States, unquote. And again, Dr. Horowitz develops the thesis that the funding of the development of immune system destroying viruses was in part meant to respond to this perceived need. And again, Dr. Horowitz makes a case, a good one, I think, though by no means airtight, that the vehicle for transmitting AIDS, probably deliberately to a number of different population groups, was the experimental hepatitis B vaccine manufactured by Merck and Company. Merck and Company is the largest manufacturer of vaccines in the world. It manufactures the vaccines for the U.S. Army. It also is a German-American corporation with a long history of involvement in biological warfare development. Earlier on in the book, Emerging Viruses, Leonard Horowitz quotes a Fort Detrick, Maryland history of the U.S. Biological Warfare Program, written appropriately enough by an individual who was named, ironically, Covert. And quoting from this report, Dr. Leonard Horowitz writes in Emerging Viruses, "From the moment of its birth in the highest levels of government, the fledgling biological warfare effort was kept to an inner circle of knowledgeable persons. George W. Merck was a key member of the panel advising President Franklin D. Roosevelt and was charged with putting such an effort together. Merck owned the pharmaceutical firm that still bears his name." So again, note where Merck fits into this complex tangle of events that we've been looking at. Turning once again to the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, again, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, authored by Christopher Simpson, we're going to turn once again to one of the central elements in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that was involved with the first of the major capital flows, the capitalizing of Germany in the 1920s and other European countries, and as well as the fourth of the capital flows, the recapitalization of Germany and Europe under the Marshall Plan. This individual is John Foster Dulles, later Secretary of State under Eisenhower, who, along with his brother Alan Dulles, a key U.S. intelligence player from the Office of Strategic Services right on up to, through his position as CIA Director under Eisenhower, the Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm and the Dulles Brothers, as we looked at in Uncle Sam and the Swastika and in the segments about the tides of 20th century capital flow, key players in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that is essential to the understanding of the evolution of fascism in the 20th century on both sides of the Atlantic. We're going to turn now to The Splendid Blonde Beast for discussion about Dulles and Sullivan and Cromwell. Of John Foster Dulles and Sullivan and Cromwell, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. His law firm had pioneered the practice of international legal support for multinational companies back in the last quarter of the 19th century, and Dulles' personal efforts consisted in large part of ensuring that such services continued to develop throughout the first half of the 20th. His first clients in his early years at Sullivan and Cromwell included a powerful German-American pharmaceutical company, Merck and Company. That's the very same Merck that made the experimental hepatitis B vaccine that Dr. Horowitz believes is probably the vehicle for infecting people with AIDS. And as we shall see, Merck, obviously a major element in this transatlantic financial and industrial axis and one of John Foster Dulles' clients at Sullivan and Cromwell, was a key player in the Bormann Flight Capital Organization as well. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in exile, the movement of German assets into Switzerland had also gone well, Bormann noted from his reports. Flight capital investments had been accomplished principally through the establishment of subsidiaries of powerful German firms. Over half the total German capital in Switzerland, for example, was used in setting up holding companies representing IG Farben, Merck, note that, Siemens, Osram, Henkel, and others. A holding company may not trade in any form. It may only hold stock in other companies, but through this device, the existing German firms and the 750 new corporations established under the Bormann program gave themselves absolute control over a post-war economic network of viable, prosperous companies that stretched from the Ruhr to the neutrals of Europe and to the countries of South America, a control that continues today and is easily maintained through the bearer bonds or shares issued by these corporations to cloak real ownership. And so again, note how some of these seemingly disparate elements fit together. Again, many of these elements have been presented before on this broadcast. That's why I've termed these two segments Connecting the Dots, and hopefully it has done just that. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.